Hello and welcome to Longevity Now, the place for all your news and views of life extension from around the world. For those of you new to the podcast or the Longevity Forum, a little history for you. 20 years ago, the forum was focused, of course, upon biological rejuvenation and life extension, but also technological progress and artificial intelligence. In fact, I was invited to the Immortality Institute, as it was known at the time, because I was a frequent visitor at KurzweilAI.net, which some of you might know as a website focused upon exponential trends and the singularity. It was known early on at the Immortality Institute that computer resources and potentially AI could be a key part to solving human aging. There are still some active discussions about these topics because they are still relevant. Human beings have been trying to solve aging for a long time, yet we are still aging, and there is no proven therapeutic intervention for reliably reversing the condition. Perhaps the latest generation of AI and other computational resources could finally help achieve a breakthrough. In order to take the pulse of progress in AI and quantum computing, we have on the podcast Dr. Jordy Rose. He has been at the forefront of quantum computing, robotics, and AI over the last 20 years, founding several companies, including D-Wave. Hear what he has to say about the current state of technological progress. And now I would like to welcome to the Longevity Now podcast, Dr. Jordy Rose, of course, founder of D-Wave and several other companies. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Rose.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Great. You know, the last time we talked, you were working with D-Wave and we were talking about quantum computing, but you've gone on to also start a couple of other companies in recent years. Could you give the audience just a little update on some of your recent entrepreneurial activities?
Sure. Not so recent, but in 2014, I left the quantum computing world to build artificial intelligence for robots, a category that's sometimes referred to as embodied artificial intelligence, where the idea is that the data that the AI trains from is the data from the perspective of the robot. So it's got a bunch of senses like vision and hearing and touch and so on. And that's just data. And you can use it to train models like people have trained language models, except it's not language anymore. It's the raw data coming from the robot. And the outputs are not written language like they are in a large language model, or images like they are in something that generates images, but they're movement. So the underlying idea is exactly the same, except the input data and the output data are a little bit different. But the idea is to have robots learn how to move in order to achieve goals in the same way that large language models like DeepSeek or any of the other variants use the written word to both train on and output. So in 2014, I started Kindred with a bunch of colleagues. And that was the first company in the world to try to do the GPT style learning in the physical world. And we had some success, but it was a little bit limited by the technological limitations of the time. And we sold that company to Ocado in 2019. And in 2018, I started what ended up being a much more ambitious effort, but in the same vein, same idea, except instead of building the physical robots being industrial robots, they were humanoids. So again, in 2018, we were the first to build humanoid robots that use these kinds of AI models. And I was there until recently. In November of 2024, I left the company. So right now I'm happily unemployed, but my main project right now has come full circle, and I'm trying to build a new kind of artificial intelligence system that uses quantum computing in a particular way that marries the best of both worlds. So the successes that have been had in reinforcement learning based artificial intelligence, trying to combine them with the quantum computing stuff in a particularly novel way. But I'm doing it by myself basically as a passion project at this point.
Okay, I know you have a newsletter too regarded to that project. For people that want to subscribe to your newsletter, what is that, Snowdrop, correct?
Yeah, the company's website is snowdropquantum.com. If you go to the blog section, you can see basically all my thoughts kind of in real time. I should warn people, though, it's a little bit technical and detail-y. At some point, this is going to be translated into something that's a lot more accessible to regular people. But right now, it's mostly a series of notes to myself. So if you're an expert in reinforcement learning and quantum computing, it might be useful to see what I'm thinking about. But for most people, it's going to be a little bit
A little
opaque.
technical. Oh, that's okay. We have a few listeners who are in that field, so I'm sure they might find it rather interesting. And you mentioned coming full circle in quantum computing. Of course, you started, co-founded D-Wave. You're the chief science officer, chief technical officer for a long time. And they went public, of course, recently. And do you have any thoughts on D-Wave or other quantum computing companies out there right now? It seems D-Wave is the only one that is commercially viable or has a commercial product right now, and it seems they may be more focusing on generating revenue from the quantum annealers. Is that the take that you would say about D-Wave right now?
Well, going back to the beginnings of the organization, the culture there was to try to solve problems that people had in the real world, which is not the same as most of the other quantum computing efforts. Most quantum computing efforts have their genesis in scientific questions, whereas we were trying to build, it was more of an engineering shop where we wanted to actually build something that worked. And that culture is carried through to the current day where the technology has gotten to the point where it is not only the underpinnings of it, the hardware part, but the software stack that sits on top of it is accessible and you can just use it in a cloud computing sense. It's very robust and stable, and anybody can do it if you put a little elbow grease behind your work. The rest of the quantum computing companies are not like that. They're much more like research labs who are trying to do science experiments. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's a place for that, but it's a different kind of thing. If you want to actually use a quantum computer in what you're doing, there isn't a lot of choice right now. You can use the D-Wave stuff and have it be stable and reliable, or you can try to use the other stuff, which isn't. I haven't been with the company or been associated with it for 11 years. So I'm trying to be more objective about this than I would usually be. It's a little bit hard because when you found something, it's kind of like your child, right, has
That's
grown up.
right.
But now that I'm just interested in the use of quantum computers and not the building of them. And I tried all of the different interfaces that the companies offer to their machines. And just being brutally honest, the only one that is a modern professional interface is the D-Wave one. The rest of them are, they're a thing, and you can try to use them, but they aren't the kind of thing you'd want to build something on. They're more just for doing experiments at this point. That'll eventually change, I think. But right now, D-Wave is probably about 10 years ahead of everybody else in terms of the maturity of the underlying commercial stack. It's not well understood because most people aren't like me and can go in and try all of them and actually see, but they're way ahead of everybody else in terms
I
of the
would
actual
tend to
use.
agree. I mean, because D-Wave is the only one who's offering a commercial product, easy to use. I know Google had a big announcement late last year with Willow, and they're computing some problem that was, only took them 5 minutes that normally would take a classical computer, they say, 10 to the 25 years to solve. But they don't appear to be offering any kind of business end use case for people who need to solve real world problems. Anyway, I haven't heard anything. Is it just an intellectual curiosity, the thing that they're doing so far? I mean, can they not offer any potential product, for businesses that is economically viable? Is it too expensive for anyone to use their product? What's going on there? We've gotten all kinds of quantum supremacy news publications saying, quantum computers are here and they're doing all these calculations. And yet, I don't see anything in my personal life that really has changed with the use of quantum computers. Like you said, D-Wave is the most user-friendly. What have you to say about more of these specialized academic type quantum computers and the gate-based, type quantum computers?
So there's a very profound question that still remains unanswered, which is whether quantum computers are actually better than classical computers at anything. This is it's kind of like a foundational question in the field that hasn't been resolved yet. So the question that Google was trying to answer with the Willow and the one before it, which is just a smaller chip but doing the same thing, is really targeted at a very foundational scientific question: is can you actually do something better with a quantum computer than you can with a classical computer? And the reason why this is such an interesting topic is that theoretically, if you just write down on pencil and paper using your quantum equations, the answer is clearly yes. So if you ask, is a quantum computer better than this? The answer is yes, theoretically. But there is a possibility that the calculations or the actual quantum mechanics itself is not the right framework to use in this regime. So I'm never going to say quantum mechanics is wrong because, you know, framework theories are, that's not like that. Everything's an approximation to something. So quantum mechanics is a very good approximation to something underlying it, probably, in the regimes in which it's been fully tested. But the quantum computing regime is a new regime that we haven't tested yet, which are these large ensembles of quantum mechanical things that all interact with each other. I'd say the dominant idea is that, yes, of course, if you could do this, then the computing stuff follows. So the Google thing was basically a science experiment to try to answer this question, like, can you actually do something better with a quantum computer than you can with a classical computer, like in reality, not in theory? And there are only two examples that I'm aware of where this thing called quantum supremacy, which is a rather unfortunate term, but basically means that the quantum computer is provably better than the classical computer at something. There are only two claims that exist right now, as far as I know, for this. One is the Google type claim, which uses a problem called random circuit sampling, which by itself is not useful for anything. It's a made up theoretical problem that's essentially designed to show quantum computers better than a classical computer. So that's the Google one. And the D-Wave one is a different supremacy result, which is a paper that was put on the archive about a year ago, where they were simulating a certain quantum system, which is a collection of magnets in their case. So there's two of these supremacy claims. But I hesitate to say that we're done because both of them could fall. So there is, I'd say it's still an open question as to whether or not either of those results is going to stand the test of time. So this is a, it's a little bit of a sobering thought that the entire quantum computing exercise may be rooted in a set of understandings that are actually not true. This is not a popular opinion in the field, by the way. Everybody kind of takes for granted that these things eventually will be quite powerful. But right now, that's not the case. There's only two claims. And I should mention, just in terms of the connection to actual utility, both of these problems are very esoteric and very difficult to actually connect to anything that anybody cares about. And the intuition people have that if a computer is like so much better than another one on a particular problem, that that will extend to things you care about is wrong. So this is not correct. Think about it this way. So nature itself does computations on a scale that are almost impossible to even comprehend. Like if you watch a tree blowing in the wind, the leaves are moving around, and that's a type of computation. The tree is computing itself, you can think of in time. And that's the way physics works. Physics is a set of equations that tell you what happens later, given some initial thing. But simulating a tree is very, very hard. You have to simulate all the wind and all of the stuff and all the rest of it. But let's say that I had the tree itself. It's simulating itself really well. Now, the question is, could I use that computer to do matrix multiplication? A different problem. And the answer is, I have no idea if I could use a tree to do matrix multiplication. Like, presumably, it's possible theoretically, but it wouldn't be very good. So, this is the problem with these quantum computing things, is that the thing that they do well is so removed from anything that you care about, that doing something you care about requires this long series of steps that eat into the advantage that you've got that eventually make it disappear. So the reason why Google is not offering a commercial service is that they haven't figured out whether it's possible to take the thing that they're good at, this weird esoteric random circuit sampling thing, and actually turn it into something useful. And potentially they'll be able to figure that out. I hope they do, but so far, no.
But as far as the hardware goes, there isn't too much limitation there, right? I mean, obviously physicists have been manipulating Cooper pairs and photons and spins and Bose-Einstein condensates, and recently there's even been a mechanical resonator that was supposedly put into superposition. As far as the hardware goes, it seems as though we can build it. But
Well,
you're
that's
saying
if it.
theoretically and on the software side, it's much more difficult proposition there.
Yeah. So if these results hold, these supremacy results, the two of them, the D-Wave one and the Google style one, if they hold, then the hardware is necessary but not sufficient to do something useful. So you need to be able to do something better, anything at all, in order for the hardware to be useful. Like, that's a requirement. So the supremacy thing has shown, again, if it holds up, that the hardware is over a bar. Now, the second question is whether you can actually use the hardware to do something useful is now a creativity and software problem. And one of the interesting things about this field is that the people who build hardware and use it are likely not the people who are going to find a way to use it usefully, because it's just not the thing. I think what's eventually going to happen is that the first commercially useful applications of these machines are going to come from outside that community. And part of the reason why I'm bullish on D-Wave is that their developer toolkit is the most easy to understand for a normal person. So if I go in as a, you know, a regular person who's, say, pretty good programmer, and I can read documents and fiddle around with APIs and stuff, I can probably learn how to use that thing to do what I want. If you look at all this other stuff, it's so weird, science, esoteric, difficult, you know, all of this language that nobody's familiar with, especially nowadays when all the smart kids are going into AI and computer science and not physics. You just don't have the background or the language to understand it. So I think there's going to be like a sociological thing that happens where the kinds of people who really want to build applications are going to, and they want to use a quantum computer, they're going to give up on all of the stuff that isn't the D-Wave stuff because it's just too hard to understand, I think. And thinking about that community itself coming up with creative applications, I just don't see it. You know, most of those people aren't like that. Like, they're a different kind of science person who's really good at doing a certain kind of thing, but being creative, thinking out of the box is generally not their strengths. So, you know, my work is trying to solve the software problem. You know, given random circuit sampling or the D-Wave stuff, is there a way to take what they've claimed they're good at and turn it into something useful? So that's the method that I've chosen, you know, my path, not worrying too much about the hardware, but just if it's good enough now, could you actually do something with it?
And speaking of hardware and software and the investment lately and all the coders, they're all going into the LLMs, the generative AIs, like ChatGPT and DeepSeek, and the making news lately. And, you know, last year when ChatGPT-4, I think, was released, I was very impressed. I thought, hey, we've crossed a certain level, a certain bar where, you know, maybe there's going to be an explosion of some new intelligence. But over the past year, I've kind of been dismayed and realized that it still seems like what they say is just a stochastic parrot. What's your thought on the development of the large language models? And is there any possibility of really developing like a artificial mind with that method?
So early on in this game, back in the days when people were first starting to build these models, I was of the opinion that they would never amount to anything more than kind of generating bad poetry, but I was wrong. The thing about this is so fascinating, is that language seems to embed a model of the world, which isn't obvious, but I think the way that people, like humanity, uses language, it's an explicit descriptor of the world, but abstract. So when I say cat, I'm referring to, like, you know, a bunch of things that trigger connections in your head, but there's an actual physical thing that it exists in the real world. It's a cat. So there's this connection between the words that we use to describe the world and the world. And I think what's happening is that the language models are discovering the model that we use at the language level, and it's good enough to do a lot of interesting things by itself. And now, it's not a model of the world. I think this is something that people don't quite get yet. Is that the actual physical world is a thing that language describes, but it's not the same. And the language models that you build are not the same as the models of the world that we have in our heads. And the, you know, one of the ways to see this is that this goes to the embodiment part, like why build robots to house AIs, is that the way that we understand the world is primarily through through our senses. You know, we see things, we touch things, we taste things, we feel things. And then we generate these concepts in our head about the world. So if I think about a cup, A cup for me is how it feels, how heavy it is, what colors I'm expecting it to be, how big I expect it to be, and so on. And these are all things that I've learned through interacting with that object in the actual physical world. They're not abstract things, they're real grounded things. So the large language models, when they first started working, made it clear that at least the language of words could be understood using a machine learning model. So that was an unexpected development, I think, for everybody. And but it turned out to be true. Now what's happening is that these things are now using reinforcement learning to try to get the models to learn how to respond better to questions without any human intervention. So the way that DeepSeek and other models like it, are the R1 model anyway, the reasoning one, works, is that the systems use, they start with a very good model of language, and then they it starts asking itself questions about what answers to questions could be. And then it starts rating them based on whether or not it achieves its goals. So this is how reinforcement learning works. And the whole thing is done without any people involved, except for setting, you know, what the goals are. And that works really well too. So the current status of things is that I think we're going to get to human-like and then eventually general and then super intelligence by basically following the steps that have been laid out and everybody's following, is that these models are being applied almost exclusively to language and visual inputs and sometimes sound for like generating music and things like this. But to generate a mind like a person's, you need to have the model live inside a robot that's like a person. And the reason for this is that you need to give it access to the interrogation of the world the same way we do. So when we're babies, you know, we put things in our mouths and we test how they look and feel and so on. And then we build notions about them that then we use to output our actions. You know, how do we behave? And that's going to happen here too. So the current models have shown the way. They need to be applied to a different kind of data, which is robot data. And then once they are, and there's enough robots out in the world, these things will develop embodied minds, like the kinds of minds that animals have, which are very different than the kinds of minds that these things are currently. And how long it will take, I'm guessing it's probably, because robots are hard to build and scale, they're going to be hardware constrained, as there aren't going to be enough of them to get enough data for a while. But eventually that's going to change. So I'd say like 10 to 15 years from now, we'll probably have fully general intelligence of the sort that we would, you know, identify as being like us. But before then, we have these wildly useful systems. And by the way, the reason I say that is that there's a killer app for all of this language stuff, and it's coding. So anybody who's an engineer who writes code sits down with one of these things now, and it helps you. Like, for example, all of the stuff that I'm doing now in my own work, I have a DeepSeek and an OpenAI tab open all the time. And I'm always asking it, how do I do this? How do I write this code? What does this line do? What does this function do? And it's basically like having a super intelligent coding partner who can just sit there and answer questions for you. And it's remarkable how good these things are. Like, I would never have guessed that they would have gotten to this stage. I mean, it's kind of a little bit like magic, how useful they are.
And that's why some people think there is some form of intelligence in there. And I was listening to some other people who were speaking about how there are components of human intelligence that are now present in some of these large language models or some of the deep learning models, such as holding a lot of data in storage, you know, memory, and recall and constructing language. And some of these things are parts of human intelligence that seem to be, you know, growing and becoming more useful in these large language models. And would you say there's some sort of emergent properties that resemble human intelligence from just the calculation that goes on in these large language models or how they interact in the current world with other, say, AIs or human beings? Is there some sort of emergent property that is more intelligent than, say, just the parts that are involved?
So the intelligence means different things to different people. So the way I think of it is the guy who actually coined the AI phrase had a way of thinking about intelligence. It's the computational part of goal seeking. So I have to parse this a little bit. So imagine I have a goal, like a very specific thing, like I'm going to win this chess game and I'm playing against you. That's my goal. So then we play. And I either win or I lose. So the idea behind this definition of intelligence is that there is an intelligence for every goal. So there's an intelligence that's associated with my chess playing ability. There's an intelligence that's associated with my ability to lift cups. There's an intelligence associated with my ability to drive a car. And all of these things are different because they're different goals. Now, in people, these things all get conflated because it's one person doing all of these different things. And it appears as though some people are better at a lot of these things, like collectively, than others, and we call them more intelligent. But in terms of like figuring out how to use this word for non-human entities, the best way to do it, in my view, is to think about a specific goal and only comparing people to machines in the context of that goal. So, for example, if I'm going to play chess against Stockfish, I'm going to lose every single time. So, I am willing to say my chess intelligence is much lower than that machine. Now, that's not what most people mean when they say intelligence. They think of something more holistic. But the problem with that is that we have no way of measuring what that holistic thing is in a machine. So it's better to come back from the grandiose and go back to the tactical and ask, is this machine better than me at something? And if so, then I'm prepared to say it's more intelligent than me at that thing. But that does not mean it's more intelligent in the sort of use colloquial use of the word. So the large language models and their derivatives are way better than us at many things already. And this shouldn't be surprising because we have machines that we all grew up with, which are much better than us at things like calculators and multiplying two big numbers are better than us. The question about whether they're better than us at everything, so that's clearly wrong. And the reason for this, and this is a particular bias that people in this field have, is that the most of the people who work in computer science have stared at screens their whole life and don't understand that most of existence occurs in the physical world and not staring at a screen. So I'm not trying to put these people down. This is a lifestyle that some people lead, but the fact is that we are physical people in a physical world, and nearly everything we do is about moving our bodies. It's not about writing code or typing or, you know, one of that. That's a part of what we do, but it's not the majority of what we do. An AI can't be intelligent like a person until it can actually physically do the things that people do. And that is a very difficult problem. It's much more difficult than generating language. Moving your body through the world is what our brains evolved for. Many people have this conception of brains as being the heart of our conscious experience and where our intelligence is and the things that fundamentally make us people. And those things are all true. But they came from the evolution of an organ. This primary function was moving us. So, in order to survive in the world, you have to react to your environment and not do stupid things. So, your brain evolved to control your body, to not have your body do stupid things and instead do smart things. And it started way back even before brains, like bacteria and organisms like this move towards sugar and away from alcohol because alcohol poisons them and sugar is their food. That choice that they're making as an organism began a process that has evolved into the life forms that we have today, including people, where the specialized organ that we've evolved, the brain, is now a very sophisticated way to think about how to move. This is why I say like general intelligence of the human type is 10 to 15 years away, is because it's not a software problem only. I think the software problem's been solved. So if one thing I can say in the defense of the LLM type approach is that I believe the algorithm for intelligence has been discovered. But the actual application of that algorithm in the correct context has not. It's still going to be robots. And an analogy would be, so let's say you came up with an internal combustion engine and you're showing it to me and you're like, look, I pour gas in here and it moves these pistons and I've discovered the car. I'm like, okay, well, where are the wheels? And they're like, what do you mean wheels? We don't need wheels. We have an engine. And I'm like, well, no, if you want to build a car, you need wheels and you need a doors and you need a steering wheel and you need. So I think that the LLMs have discovered the engine of intelligence. Like they're the thing that makes it go. But the car, which is the actual really intelligent creature, is still a future thing. We're not there yet. And it's going to
Okay.
take a while to get there.
Yeah, and you mentioned, of course, the time frame here. Perhaps we're going to continue to see some acceleration in this field. Could you speak briefly about AI safety and robotics safety? Of course, there are some people out there who are very concerned about that, the alignment problem and different things. What's your take on that, and how do we safely move into this future?
Well, the thing about the robots is that, at least in their commercial utility, there's a natural safety pipeline. So, if I want to use a robot in my factory, I've got a bunch of requirements that I need to fulfill that are both regulatory and just in terms of my own business, that I'm not going to bring something into my factory that's going to wreck stuff. So the factory type robots have to undergo safety certifications that are quite stringent, and they're there for a reason. And I think that that will apply here as well. The reason I'm hesitating is that there are a lot of uses of robots that people are putting through now that don't go through those types of regulations. And I'm thinking specifically of drones. So drones are a kind of robot, they fly, and people are using them to weaponize them. And there are also drone equivalents that are underwater things, things that swim instead of fly. And these kinds of military type applications have very different objectives than the kinds of commercial applications that I'm used to dealing with. So in my world, you build a robot to solve a problem and it does it better than your competitors and you can offer it cheaper and you sell it. And part of that is safety. But that doesn't mean that everybody's subject to those guidelines. So I think that there actually is an issue that's arising that autonomy that is giving the robot ability to make decisions makes it a better weapon. And this is incontrovertible because they're faster, they react quicker, and so on. But what you do when you give a machine autonomy is you get performance at a cost, which is you're no longer in control of what it does. So there's a natural pathway in the weaponization of this type of technology where autonomy gets you better performance, and therefore it's going to be the choice because in some of these situations, you just want to win. You don't care how. And I understand that. And by the way, I'm not against this. I think it's a necessary part of the way that Western democracies are going to need to defend themselves in the future. We can't put our heads in the ground and just, ignore this because our adversaries will not. They're going to do this. So, it's going to be a new type of adversarial challenge where a new, extremely powerful technology, which is like the mind of an animal, is now being released into the world. And we can build these little quasi animals like drones and so on. And people being who they are, our natural instinct is to fight. And that instinct is going to drive the development of the types of goals we give these machines. And so I think in terms of the safety side, there's a category of things where safety is a bonus and you kind of have to have it. And that's where all the commercial uses. But there's a category of things where safety is actually not a bonus. In fact, it's the thing that you want to avoid. And those are the military applications. So I think if there's going to be problems, they will arise from the weaponization of these things. But I don't think it's an existential problem like most people do. I think it's the kind of problem that nuclear weapons present. So everybody knows nuclear weapons could end civilization. We've lived with that since, the late 40s, but they haven't. So this type of technology, I think, will probably be around the same, is that there will be ways to use it that are terrible and bad for everybody, but people will generally not do that. And I think that the reason is that it's one of these mutually assured destruction things is that there are certain lines when you cross them, every reasonable person would say, this isn't even good for me. And even if you're not reasonable. So I don't
So
know.
we'll probably f you suspect we'll find ways to deal with the dangers.
Yeah. And we have so far, like our technological evolution keeps accelerating. So we can't necessarily depend on the past to predict the future. We're entering into a phase now where technology is evolving faster than we can keep up with it. So there might be all sorts of unintended consequences of that. But, it's kind of like I mentioned that the algorithm for intelligence has likely been discovered. The horse has left the barn. And the question is, how are we going to act in order to make sure that the horse doesn't come back and like stomp her?
I hear you. I hear you. Yeah, and you're obviously intimately involved in this progress with quantum computing and artificial intelligence. And obviously, you want to live to see the day, probably to a spectacular future if we can navigate that. What do you do right now? This is a life extension based podcast. What do you do right now to stay healthy in order to stay young and healthy for the next few years? Any advice on how you maintain your drive and your health?
Well, I mean, I think everybody kind of knows the base things that you need to do to remain healthy. You need to sleep a lot. I think that's the number one. You have to get good sleep hygiene. You need to get regular exercise, which I do.
Wrestling
Actually,
still?
jujitsu.
Jiu-jitsu.
I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I'm on a trajectory to eventually get a black belt at some point, as long as I don't die of old age before that. So I've been working on that
Well, there's a
goal
little
for a long
tidbit,
time.
getting involved in social exercise seems to be some of the best types of exercise to keep people healthy. Well, yeah. Well, that's interesting to know. Yeah, I mean, obviously, okay, the basics. Everyone get down the basics, get your exercise,
Yeah,
maybe
I think
try
that
some jiu-jitsu.
the at least if you're not doing anything extreme,
Sure.
it's a pretty simple thing in theory, but again, in practice, it's difficult. Is that prioritize sleep, have a routine and don't vary from it, be generally healthy, which means,
Sure.
avoid things that are obviously not good for you. And I think that's that then your genetics, of course, takes over. Like if you're going to have a heart attack or a stroke, it's probably genetically determined more than your lifestyle. There's things you can do to affect it, but genes
Okay.
play a big role in it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rose, for joining us here on the Longevity Now podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
After speaking with Dr. Rose, I got the feeling that we are at a make or break point in the quest for age reversal. With every tool humans have ever created, there is promise and peril. Depending upon who you talk to, AI will either save or destroy humanity in fairly short order, perhaps within the next few years. As we leverage artificial intelligence to help us solve the problems associated with aging, we might also need to focus increasingly upon AI safety. Until next time, I'm Justin Lowe.